I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. Our guest this hour is Kevin Phillips, political strategist and writer. His new book is called Bad Money. Kevin Phillips, you know that I take you seriously for 35 years now on the workings of American politics, more recently on the temptations of empire, theocracy, and collapse. This new book, Bad Money, I think is your most stylish, but it's also the scariest. I mean, cut to the chase. How bad is it, this reckless finance, failed politics, and the global crisis of American capitalism?
Well, I think it's pretty bad in one dimension. There's talk about how this is the greatest financial crisis since the 1930s. I suspect that for the United States, it won't be anything like what happened in the 1930s when the stock market dived 80% and unemployment hit 25% and the Okies did their big migration to California. That's not in the cards. But what I think is in the cards is something very stressful for this country. There's a growing sense that the imperial era of the United States is over almost before it started. And I think that we're seeing the weakness of a United States that has allowed the financial sector to take over the private economy. That is now the largest portion, 20 to 21% of GDP is finance, pushing manufacturing way down. And I don't think that the financial sector is responsible enough, safe enough, broad-minded enough to fill that position. I think that what you'll see happen to the United States is over-financialization, too much debt, too much over-expansion, and a degree of an implosion that will involve everything from too much debt and collapsing home prices to rising oil prices and the declining dollar. It's all converging. It's all trouble. It doesn't spell the end of the United States, but it spells the end of the United States as the total big cheese in the world, and we're going to lose some of the yardsticks that everybody enjoyed for a long time.
This word financialization runs through your book and your analysis. We know vaguely what it means, a country awash in debt, what, three or four times the public and private debt today than when George W. Bush took office. And we know that China manufactures everything. But just what does this mean, the financialization of a manufacturing power like ours?
Well, I think in the case of the United States, this goes back effectively 25 years, maybe even more. And you're looking at a transformation in the American economy away from one that produced things to one that moves money around. But it didn't happen overnight. One of the major relationships is between the rise of debt and the rise of a debt culture. Now, the debt culture in government meant deficits and spend now and play and pay later. The whole rise of the consumerist, the public's debt tolerance to an extraordinary degree, and this general lackadaisicalness of really putting a rigorous framework around your culture and your economy. They've all sort of gone to seed together. Mm-hmm. And I think that the net outcome of this is a country that in every way is living beyond its means. We used to be the leading world creditor nation and the leading world manufacturer and the leading world producer of oil. We're now the world's leading debtor. We're the largest importer of manufacturers in the world, and we're the largest importer of oil in the world. It's a disastrous transformation. And the only part of the economy that's really profited has been the financial sector, because an awful lot of the transition is a transition towards more debt, more credit, more living on things you can't afford, more keeping up pretenses, and more ambition around the world with less to back it up. And the consummation of this in many ways has been the George W. Bush administration.
You know, one of the questions that kept coming to my mind reading your book, Kevin Phillips, was, where is Paul Krugman? I count on him to tell us the bad news we ought to know, and there's a lot of it. But you're way over the top compared to Krugman. I mean, he's been saying that they sort of faked and shaked their way through the crisis of the housing bubble and the subprime loans. Are we through it or not?
No, I don't think so. But there's a good reason for Paul and for the Democrats in general to be more upbeat here. Maybe to an extent, if things were a lot further advanced in the decay process, you could just flip a leaf and say all of a sudden we're ferociously concerned about this decay. But they think that liberal policies and the democratic approach can turn it around. Frankly, I don't.
What's the nature of their bet? What's the democratic magic?
Well, I think the democratic magic is sort of more of the old democratic razzmatazz and governmental step in, and there's going to be a Green Deal as well as a New Deal, and we're going to have 5 million new jobs from things relating to the greening of America. Sort of reminds me of the greening of America 40 years ago. You remember that one?
I think the Democrats... But this is the Tom Friedman Green Revolution, which, as a reader, I suspect, I mean, it's his penance for Iraq, but it sounds, I've written this, more like the road into Iraq than the road out. It's all very corporate, very, very patriotic, muscular, but it doesn't sound like it gets to more modest, careful treatment of the globe. Is that the Green Deal you're talking about?
Well, partly. I think the Democrats... don't want to admit that what they did for the most part during the two Clinton administrations was a continuation of a number of the weaknesses of the Reagan and first Bush administration, and then was continued and built upon by the second Bush administration. You had a lot of financial deregulation under the Democrats, repeal of Glass-Steagall, they deregulated credit cards, lots of stuff. And they just stepped on the gas pedal in terms of private debt. The increase is extraordinary. So I can't separate out the Clinton years from what preceded them and what has come after them. And, of course, the Democrats need to be able to tell America in this election that there's just no continuity between them. They're totally different, and they've got the answer. I understand that, but I don't agree with it.
You also write in the book that in this period, even after the Bill Clinton administration, Bill himself, living in New York, and Senator Clinton running for president now, have been part of the financialization of the party, the Wall Streetization of the party. What does that mean?
Well, first of all, they moved to New York. That wasn't their locus before. And I think it's extraordinary how Hillary in the last 3 months or so has lost any semblance of her former Eastern accent and has sort of gotten an accent that sounds like a shot awry with a beer chaser after the Pennsylvania and West Virginia. But they had made a transformation before into essentially representing the financial sector. Bill Clinton signed up with his fellow Ron Burkle, who was a billionaire, into various hedge funds and mutual funds, collected a lot of money from him. Chelsea worked for a hedge fund. Hillary Clinton represented and got an awful lot of support from finance, not unusual. A senator from New York. But it does suggest that they morphed during this period. And I think they were expecting to be able to play the restoration game. Hmm. And it's just all off the tracks now.
How different is Barack Obama, who has a lot of Wall Street support too?
Well, he has a lot of Wall Street support, but he does lack the framework of 8 years in the White House following the policies that Clinton and Bob Rubin followed. So in that sense, Obama isn't committed to the past and to the implementation and the people of the Clinton years. Hmm. But having said that, I don't think he's raised enough of these issues to be able to come into office with a mandate. And if you don't come into office with a mandate, I don't think you can turn on a dime after an election campaign in which nobody's talked in any depth about any of these problems, and then all of a sudden say, hey, this is a disaster shaping up here. I mean, suppose that we have in March and April of 2009, when the new administration is in and the new Congress is in, an economy which has gone downhill from here, where housing is continuing to collapse, or joblessness is gone up another point. What are they going to do? Are they going to say, oh, well, that's too bad. We didn't really see that coming. They're not acting now like people that understand there's a problem. If they have to all of a sudden develop that in March and April of 2009, I'm not sure they'll do a very good job. That clearly goes for the Republicans. It's hard to believe McCain, his economic program, is almost a non-program. But I think the real acid test comes from, if, as we assume the Democrats get in, how much can they really deliver?
Hmm. Kevin Phillips, It's the trajectory of your books that makes you so interesting, as well as the substance of these books. 40 years ago, you were onto the Southernization of American politics, and you helped make it happen with Richard Nixon in 1968, the emerging Republican majority and all that. And then when I got to know you, you were very sour on liberal media in that book, Mediocracy. But for 25 years now, it's the ascendant Republicans that you say have been corrupted by power and the arrogance of it and who've gone imperial on us and theocratic in the Bush and Clinton cases. They've also gone dynastic. In this period of your eminence, Kevin Phillips, you've gone from a sort of strategic and tactical wise guy to populist grand historian of English and American cultures and empires, the rise and fall of empires, and now perhaps the collapse of the global financial system. Tell us your story, and where does this thread project into the future in your own evolution?
Well, I think in the aftermath of the emerging Republican majority, the politics of the Republican Party at that point was mostly foreign policy and cultural issues and social issues. They'd come into office in 1969 with inflation being a problem, which is a very easy thing for Republicans to run against, even if they don't always deal successfully with it. They're equipped to run against it. Then, of course, Watergate came along, and the Democrats had it from 1976 to 1980 and got trapped by inflation and a bad economy, and you got Ronald Reagan. Now, I didn't support Ronald Reagan's economics. His economics were too much of the back to Calvin Coolidge and the market is good for you and up, up and away and Adam Smith ties and everything. So that was the first source of dissonance. But I voted for Reagan in both elections. Then in 1990, I wrote a book called The Politics of Rich and Poor that said some of this was getting out of control. There was too much of a polarization in what were fairly unfair American economics. Didn't strike me that it was a major disassociation because the lead quote on the back of the book jacket was from my old boss, Richard Nixon, who agreed with the book. So There were a lot of Republicans from the 60s and 70s evolving away from elements of the Reagan years.
The last of the cloth coat Republicans, shall we say.
Well, I suppose so. And the Reagan people represented the famous Reagan Democrats. And by the time George H.W. Bush came in, a lot of them didn't like the new Republicanism either. There was this great thing about George H.W. being so preppy that, you know, you practically expected to see him do bulla bulla. And that was disliked by a lot of the Reaganites. And then the sun gets in, and once you got, well, you know, just the whole package. I don't really want to do another number on George W. after American Dynasty, but I think he's the wrong person at the wrong time in the wrong place and essentially unqualified to have been president of the United States during these 8 years.
You wrote 8 years ago, and I'll never forget two lines from that period, that the Bush campaign was attempting a restoration, something like the Bourbon monarchy after the collapse of Napoleon, Louis XVIII and then Charles X, or comparable to the Stuart King Charles II of England after Cromwell and the English Civil Wars in the 17th century. What kind of a restoration does this turn out to have been?
Well, it turns out to have been a very unfortunate restoration, but so were the restoration of the Stuarts and of the Bourbon, because basically what you had in France within 14 years of the restoration, you had in 1830 the getting rid of Charles, the last of the Bourbons. And when you went and looked at the British restoration, which started in the early 1660s, by 1688, you had getting rid of the Stuarts and the glorious revolution that brought William and Mary to the throne of England. So what you had were failed restorations. You were trying to bring back the old because you were tired of the new. Now, the new in Britain, in England, was Cromwell and the Puritans, and the new in France were first the Jacobins and all the extremists, and then Napoleon. So people got tired of them, and they'd forgotten how bad the others were, and they brought them back. And my feeling is that in the United States of 2000, people were sort of disgusted with the amorality of Bill Clinton and the notion that, you know, he was Monica Lewinsky's mentor and that was all that was involved there, and the general scuzz of Clintondom, and somehow saw the Bushes as bringing back the old morality, the whole Barbara Bush image with the books about the dogs and the pearls and so forth. And they did represent a much more religious approach, and that was one of the things that got out of control. But basically what you had was a kind of naivete on the part of the American people that you could bring these people back in and they were going to solve something. It's frightening how history can, if not repeat, at least rhyme.
Restoration without the comedy this time.
Oh, there's a comedy. Every time he goes on television, there's a comedy.
The other line I remember from 2000 was you reminded us that Bush-Cheney was the first all-oil ticket in American history. How does that look in retrospect, especially because not only the oil prices keep going up, we've had a genuine full-fledged oil war still going on, but that oil and the rivalry with China and India is the coin of the new realm. I mean, how much did these guys anticipate it? How much? What did they do to deal with it? Or were they just in for the short-term ExxonMobil profits?
I think it's very difficult to be totally sure of what you say on this, because there were a number of motivations for George W. when going into Iraq. Oil was obviously one, as Alan Greenspan says. Geopolitics was another. And I think religion was a third. An awful lot of the Republican coalition, people who believed in the Bible and the end times and Armageddon, and he had to be careful that he interpreted what was going on in the Middle East in a way that didn't throw them out of whack. Now, having said that, the fact that he and Cheney came from the oil business turned out to be one of the most extraordinary, you know, I have to say, jokes in a sense, because both of them were supposedly expert, and they get in there and they invade Iraq partly in order to get the Iraq oil, which hasn't been tapped too much historically, and they thought they might get 6 or 7 million barrels a day, and they could use that to bust open OPEC, and that would bring the price down. That was their ambition. And the futures market showed briefly in 2003 that there was an expectation that oil would come down to $15 to $18 a barrel. Mm. Well, at the time, it was 20 to 25, and now, of course, it's 120 to 125. And the notion that this imbecility was orchestrated, totally contrary to what they wanted, by two people who came from the oil industry. We could have done better with two bums or two good humor men than we did with these two guys from the oil industry who knew nothing about the forces they were unleashing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other rationales for the war was that it would keep the Persian Gulf oil away from the Chinese, keep China on its bicycle, so to speak. But then again, that didn't happen either.
Well, it wasn't going to happen. And, you know, I hesitate to say how much they knew or they didn't know. But the Saudis in the summer of 2002, after they started to get disenchanted with the war drums beating over Iraq, started shifting their oil exports to China. Mm-hmm. And China moved ahead of the United States as the principal source of Saudi exports. And this is easy to I've got something about it in the book. It's just not hard to pin down at all. But that should have been a sign that this whole strategy of thinking that they could ace the Chinese and pull the plug on OPEC and flood the world with oil and put the United States back, you know, holding the flag in Iwo Jima in energy terms or something. You can never underestimate the lack of confidence of their strategic, you know, intent. In any event, it came a cropper. It was as dumb as that landing on the carrier and, you know, the fighting is over. Mm. I mean, they were right about practically nothing.
Mm. Would you recast your version of the housing bubble and how it burst, Kevin? Especially because the line out there in the main media is that we dodged that bullet and that the market has been restabilized somehow.
Well, I think that their principal line is that the credit crisis has been... We've been through the worst, and it's somewhere between half and two-thirds over. Now, I don't agree with that either, but that's a more moderate statement than to say we've dodged the bullet on the housing crisis, because that's not nearly over. Greenspan, who, of course, after his record of predicting things and knowing things you shouldn't take as too much of an expert, is talking about how the housing prices will hit bottom in 2009. They always keep it a year out, roughly, but they always want to look like it's just over the horizon. I don't think too many people really think that it'll end in 2009, because of the typical serious housing crisis historically in the United States, it's run about 5 years. And that would suggest probably 2010 or 2011. Now, the history of this, as far as I can see, and I'll give you a very quick summary, and then you can come back for more detail if you want. But in a nutshell, Greenspan was a big expert on how stimulus could be tapped from housing price run-ups if people would refinance and take out new mortgages, and they would basically then take money out of the increase in housing values and put it in the rest of the economy. And he'd seen this happen in the 70s and in the 80s. So after the tech and stock market bubble collapsed in 2000 and 2001, it's pretty clear that Greenspan saw another opportunity here. So did plenty of others, so he wasn't alone. And they pushed the interest rate down to 1% in the summer of 2003, which was just like opening up spigots for real estate. And they grossly simplified mortgage procedures, although they made them into gimmicks. These were all the subprime gimmicky loans, or it's just interest-only ballooning, adjustable rate, decide whether you're going to pay this year or whether you're going to wait a couple of years.
This is the ninja market, you call it.
Yeah, it's just mind-blowing stuff.
Ninja meaning no income, no job, no assets.
Right, right. And plenty of others. There was the neutron loan, and that's it kills the people but leaves the housing standing. all of which were good descriptions of what was going on. But the real thing that they did that made this gain legs was that no matter how crummy the mortgages were that were made and how negligent, most of them were securitized. Now, what that meant was they were fed into a kind of mortgage central where the lenders sold them to the major financial institutions that packaged them, securitized them as mortgage-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations, and that meant you were putting 400, 800, 1,500 loans together in a new package. And they didn't keep their little labels for where they came from. They were modeled, and it was decided that, 70% would get AAA, and 20% would get AA, and 5% would get BBB, and then 5% would be just B, which is pretty bad. And, of course, that was a gross misrepresentation. The ratings people had been sort of suborned, and they were part of the game. And so this stuff was then sold in this country, but also overseas. A lot of it went overseas. And then, lo and behold, in the summer last year, August, we see it starting to blow up. Because, sure, they spread the risk. They spread the risk into places it had never been before. I mean, it's mind-boggling. If these people were in the manufacturing business, the production of these things would have been enjoined because they were unsafe. You have consumer product safety commissions and things like that. You don't have a financial product safety commission, which we sure as hell should have.
That is part of the hazard of financialization, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Go back to the political campaign. What is it that Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and John McCain are not saying and ought to be saying? I mean, one of them is going to inherit the problem.
Well, I would just take of all the things that I have in the book that I describe as sharks circling the economy. And we have one of these once or twice century convergences. We start out with financialization of the country, which is dangerous in itself. We have this enormous record buildup of debt. We have the collapsing of home prices. We have global commodity inflation for energy and food. We have all kinds of rotten statistics that are starting to be called into question now that they don't work. We have the question of peak oil that, besides rising prices, we may be running out in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And then we have the collapse of the dollar. Now, all of these things come together, And I think that's one reason why they don't really want to talk about any of them. They want to talk about nonsense like the gas tax holiday for the summer, or you're going to dump some checks, or you're going to bail out homeowners. They will not connect the dots. They will not put the history in place. They will not put the bipartisan failure aspect in place. In short, they're finally taking the duopoly of Democrats and Republicans to the ultimate sort of know-nothing, because we did it together. We can't really talk about it.
And where's the media? Where's the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Financial Times?
Well, they're hither and yon. They come to some small grips with it, and then they dance away. What they really don't want to do yet is connect the dots. They don't want to connect the dots. They don't want to discuss the huge emergence of the financial sector in a way that's never happened before, at the same time as you've got collapsing home prices to a greatest degree since the 1930s, and then the whole oil thing. They can't deal with connecting the dots. So as a result, they have not put pressure on the politicians, but they can fairly say that they can't really cover this until some of the politicians talk about it. So basically, they're sort of covering for each other, because nobody's made a move to take it all really seriously.
So what happens? I mean, this is people among the nightmare fantasies is a kind of backing into World War One, maybe starting in the Middle East, or a collapse of the globalization boom that would make the Depression look like a picnic. What do you think?
I hesitate to say things happen that make the Depression look like a picnic, because probably they won't be as bad, but they're going to affect a far more sophisticated and intricately arranged set of mechanisms, which are bound to lose a lot of effectiveness. And I think that's not being grappled with. It's clear that in terms of energy policy, there are all kinds of new alliances against the United States and against the dollar, and in favor of a market dominated by government-run oil companies, which own 80% of the oil now. We're just really behind the eight ball on this. And even oil company presidents are calling for a national energy and national energy security strategy. So we don't get that from anybody. We don't get any attention to the financialization of the economy and how politicians now get most of their money from the financial sector. I understand why they don't want to call attention to the role of some of their major benefactors, but it's difficult. We don't see any honest discussion of the enormous buildup of debt and how the private debt buildup is actually more of a threat in the near term, 2 or 3 years, than the public debt is. I don't quite understand why the media are so reluctant here. I'm hesitate to come up with any grand theory, but they don't want to be out front. They don't want to be out front on bad news. That's generally true. The politicians don't want to talk about it. And the upshot is you've got this dilly-dallying dialogue to put together some crazy grouping of words that just doesn't go anywhere.
Where do you get your information, and who are the – what's the circle of friends and authorities that confirm your very dark view?
Well, it's easy enough to talk about people who share some of my viewpoints. I think that's a fair thing to do. There are certainly a number who believe in the enormity of the debt buildup. They're mostly not in Republican and Democratic politics, but outside of it. I hold no great brief for Ron Paul, but a lot of his crowd are fearful of all of this and fearful of the Fed's role in helping to stimulate it. You know, in terms of the oil issue and peak oil, there's a whole group called the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. And I found, I went down to Texas for this book a week or so ago, that there, behind the scenes, there's a growing sense that, yeah, maybe supply is peaking 20 or 30 years out. They're a little cautious that way. But they certainly admit that demand is outgrowing supply. So they're coming to a lot of the same conclusions. And they lament that the Bush administration is like the three monkeys, you know, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. So, again, on energy, there's some support. In terms of the fearfulness about the economy and a potential financial crisis, you can quote people like Paul Volcker, to a certain extent Alan Greenspan, George Soros, many, many, many.
Kevin, everybody loves the Are We Rome gang? Are we going the way of the great empires of Holland, Spain, Britain, and the rest? And you do it somewhat in the book. Run the symptoms.
Well, the symptoms, if you want to take a broad view, I started out 25 years ago thinking about some of the economic parallels. Then it grew during the 90s and the early Bush years. So I came up with the first parallel is a sense that the public has and the public had in all of these places of things going wrong, of what we call being on the wrong track. The second thing is you have a transformation away from what the country or the empire used to do in terms of its economic strength, away from industry, agriculture, fishing, maritime affairs, whatever it was, towards a financialization, which becomes possible when this country becomes, as all the leading world economic powers did, the big cheese in the economic world.
Hmm.
The third thing that you would get would be a growing importance of religion, generally a crusading religion, an intolerant religion, a would-be state religion, as with Rome, the intolerance with Spain, the missionary aspect with the British, and with the United States, very much like the British, and the whole biblical thing, which the British did too. Then you get the overseas adventurism, and generally speaking, these empires lost a lot of their ground when they got in wars they couldn't win and they couldn't afford anymore, whether it was the Romans on the frontier or the Spanish in the 30 Years' War in the 17th century, the Dutch from 1688 to 1713, and the British in World Wars I and II. And then last but not least, you get an enormous buildup of debt. And ultimately, the debt is to both maintain the economy that you can't really afford some of it anymore and to maintain the foreign adventurism. And ultimately, the debt gets you like World Wars I and II basically just plucked the British balloon. And they were so badly off after World War II when the currency collapsed, they even had food rationing for 6 or 7 years in peacetime. This was the country that was on top of the world in 1914. That's how quickly it came, 35 years.
Hmm. Let me ask you what I asked Gore Vidal once. Is this rush to empire reversible? And he said, of course it's reversible by collapse, and don't let the column hit you on the way out. What do you think?
You know, I wouldn't choose his way of coming at it. I would say it isn't reversible in its principal incarnation, by which if you're the imperial power banking this huge amount of debt or debanking it, spreading your wings in places where you can't fly any longer without the wax melting, overstretching yourself militarily, you can't reverse all of that. You can't just say, oh, well, we'll back up. We'll back up to where we were in 1965. That'll be nice again. That never works. What you have to do, you have to go through what I think of as the post-imperial ringer. You sort of lose your global status. You lose your global military hegemony. You lose your currency hegemony. You become a weak economic power instead of a strong one. All of these things force a country that's been top dog to go through two or three decades, sometimes two or three generations, of getting out of what you had been and becoming something much less. But the pangs of the transformation and the hangovers from the transformation are painful. And they certainly were for the Brits and they were for the Dutch. And we're going to have problems, and I just hope that the transformation, if it can be achieved by the 2040s or 50s, can take us out of what's going to be a problem in getting rid of what we are now and have now into a different framework, a post-imperial framework, so to speak.
Mm. Kevin Phillips, this is absolutely fascinating. It's part of the syndrome, maybe, that these premonitions of collapse are so incredibly entertaining. Your book is fascinating, absorbing, as well as scary. Thank you enormously for joining us. It's great to hear you on Open Source.
Thank you, Chris.